We've still yet to hear any good reason to think that God does not exist. Now, don't use up my time here. Mr. Zinglish says you can't prove a universal negative. That's false in the first place. Of course you can. For example, you could disprove the statement that there are polka-dotted geese. That would be a universal negative. You can disprove that. But more importantly, the statement that God does not exist is not a universal negative. It's a singular negative statement. And certainly you can prove negative singular statements, such as there is no planet between Venus and the Earth. You can provide arguments to show that a singular negative statement is true. But he hasn't done it. But he says the idea of God is so impalpable. Now, look, if this is not just going to be a sort of village atheism where you say, well, I can't see and touch and hear God, so he doesn't exist, you've got to have a better objection than that. Perhaps Mr. Zindler is saying, well, because God can't be verified, this is a meaningless statement that God exists or that God does not exist. Indeed, he seems to indicate this in some of his writings. This is based, however, upon a verificationist theory of meaning, which is simply false and self-refuting. Number one, this type of theory of meaning would not only eliminate God's statements, it would eliminate ethical statements, aesthetic statements, many metaphysical statements, and many scientific statements, like statements about quarks, strings, other high-level theoretical entities in science. Secondly, even worse, this verification theory of meaning is self-refuting. If you say to be meaningful, a proposition must be verifiable, what about that very proposition? Is it verifiable? Well, no, it's just an arbitrary definition. So that it was very soon realized that this verification theory of meaning, if it were true, it's meaningless. So that it's a self-refuting theory. And therefore, this verification theory of meaning that Mr. Zindler is propounding has been abandoned universally today by epistemologists, theorists of knowledge. So that it is not at all absurd to say that you have to give some sort of argument against God if you're going to maintain atheism. He says, well, maybe I'm God. Well, I think this just trivializes the debate this evening. Mr. Zindler obviously didn't bring about the origin of the universe or design it. He's not the source of absolute moral value. If we're going to have a serious debate, I think we need to weigh the alternatives that are really credible. So I haven't seen any refutation of my first three arguments for a creator, a designer, or a source of moral values. What about the evidence for God's revealing himself in Jesus? Here, all we got, frankly, from Mr. Zindler was a series of assertions, but no evidence to support them. He says, but the Gospels aren't credible. Why take them seriously? They're not eyewitnesses. Let me make a couple of quick points. Number one, he falsely assumes that only an eyewitness can write accurate history. And that just evinces an incredible historiographical naivete. It's positively medieval, literally, in its understanding of history. It would mean that today nobody could write a history of the American Civil War, for example. So that just because some of the gospel writers aren't eyewitnesses, you can't throw them out as unreliable. Secondly, he falsely assumes that a historically reliable document must be inerrant. He has a sort of all-or-nothing mentality. If there's any errors, then the whole document is worthless as a historical source. And again, that would just destroy the whole study of history. The task of the critical scholar is to sort out the historical from the unhistorical elements. One could admit all of the discrepancies Mr. Zindler mentions and still hold that the Gospels warrant the conclusion that Jesus rose from the dead and are fundamentally reliable sources for a life of Jesus. In fact, this is precisely the position that many biblical critics do hold. And remember, this isn't a debate tonight over biblical inerrancy. It's a debate over who was Jesus and his resurrection. And I would maintain, number three, that the Gospels are fundamentally reliable. I can only look at one example, Luke. Luke was not an eyewitness, but he was a traveling companion of Paul. And as such, he traveled to Jerusalem where he interviewed people who were eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus. His accuracy in the book of Acts is indisputable. A best demonstration of this is a recent book by Colin Hemer called The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History. Hemer combs the book of Acts, sorting out incredible historical detail that is confirmed by papyrological and epigraphical evidence from the first century. Sir William Ramsay's judgment still stands. Luke is a historian of the first rank. This author should be placed among the very greatest of historians. Now, let me contrast with that Mr. Zindler's view on the origin of Christianity. He believes Jesus never existed. He says the character now known of Christ, as Christ, was the product of an unstably rotating earth. Right. He thinks that the earth rotated in such a way that the zodiacal sign shifted around the time of the birth of Christ, and this caused wise men to come from the east seeking a new God, and their visit prompted the Jews to believe their messianic expectations had already been fulfilled. Let me just mention 3 points about this. Number one, it's astronomically impossible. The ancients could not have observed the change in the equinox from Aries to Pisces, as Mr. Zindler says. Knowles Werdlow, who's professor of astronomy at the University of Chicago, made this point. He said, to think that people in antiquity could distinguish between the different signs is ludicrous, because only later did people place borders around the stars. This was done for modern cataloging purposes in 1900 at the Astronomical Union. This line of thinking, that is Mr. Zindler's, is clearly invented and not at all representative of what the people in that time saw. What he has written has absolutely no historical value whatsoever. Secondly, it's even worse. He gratuitously accepts the visit of the wise men as historical while rejecting better established and universally accepted facts about the historical Jesus. He rejects the crucifixion, he rejects the existence of Jesus, but he accepts the visit of the wise men. What makes this ironic is that the wise man story is one of those that's usually rejected by critical biblical scholars today. So this is just intellectual hypocrisy. It's sort of picking and choosing what you want to believe. Thirdly, the Jews couldn't possibly have believed that the Messiah had already come and done what was prophesied of him, because they expected a temporal political Messiah. So long as they still labored under the Roman yoke, they couldn't possibly have believed their messianic expectations were fulfilled. In fact, that leads to another question. Why is the Jesus of the gospel so different from the Jewish messianic expectations? If he was supposedly the imaginary product of those expectations. In particular, there was no expectation of a dying and rising Messiah. You can't explain the origin of Christianity through these influences because there was no expectation of it. What about pagan influences on the disciples? Well, the fact is that according to Gerhard Kittel, there is virtually no trace in Palestine in the first century of these pagan myths of dying and rising gods. So that their influence upon the disciples, I think, is simply unthinkable. So that we've yet to see any explanation for the consensus of scholarship today that the tomb was empty, they saw appearances of Jesus alive, and they originated this belief in his resurrection without any prior sort of pagan, Christian, or Jewish influences. Again, then, it seems to me that it's pretty obvious that the evidence points toward Christianity as the more plausible worldview.
Well, I'm glad to see that he has read my article on how Jesus got a life. But I must say that I did not assert for sure that the Magi were real. I simply thought that would be a useful thing. If it were true, it could explain some things. But we don't need to believe that the Magi, in the sense of the Bible story, were historical. But there were, of course, Magi. These were Mithraic astrologers who did travel around. One of their centers was Tarsus. You may have heard of somebody else from Tarsus. We're told that the verification principle is passé, but curiously, he did not do anything to try to refute the simple truth that I am God and created you all 3 minutes ago. The only way you can get out of that dilemma is if this verificationist principle or something very similar to it is correct. And it is not indeed a meta statement. That statement itself is unverifiable. It is simply an observation. This is how we do, in fact, determine whether we can make sense out of anything, is if we can imagine a way, at least in principle, that we could test it. And those things that we can't even imagine a way to test, we just shrug off and go on to something else. And again, the problem of universal negative, there are many, 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 many gods that have been claimed, and how to disprove all of them, I wouldn't imagine to know. With regard to polka-dotted geese, that is also a universal negative, to try to disprove that somewhere in the universe at some time there never was a polka-dotted goose. So I'm not going to try to disprove that one either. Purple polka-dotted geese and gods are both a little bit tough to handle in this sense. Now, he keeps coming back to the circumstantial species of the ad hominem, and there are two species of ad hominem. There is the abusive species, where you just simply call somebody a name, and the circumstantial species, where you appeal to the special circumstances, either of your opponent or to the audience, and hope that that will sway them. For example, if somebody is on trial for abusing animals, and you give an impassioned speech that abusing animals is awful and animals shouldn't have to suffer, that's all well and good, but it does nothing to prove the guilt of the person being tried. And so this idea of a moral vacuum, if the Christian God does not exist, is irrelevant. But certainly it is emotionally relevant to all of us. And I have written on the principle of enlightened self-interest, which shows that if we are sensible about it, about finding gratification for our needs, maximizing them in duration as well as in intensity, and in number of occurrences, that we will then cooperate with our fellow human beings, because we can have symphonies with cooperation, and without them we cannot even have a song. And I showed also that with this principle of enlightened self-interest, this leads to a desire for justice, because if somebody does try to grab more than is his or her fair share, this will hurt you sooner or later. And so it is to your advantage, there again, to pass up this opportunity to grab something which is not yours and suffer the consequences along with everyone else. When everything is just, you stand to gain all the more. And so it is an enlightened type of selfishness, and I submit it is certainly a better system than the Christian God has displayed. Keep in mind, the God of the Bible commanded genocide, which made Hitler look like a piker, kill all the Jebusites, the Midianites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, kill all. We have the story of Jesus saying, unless you hate your father and your mother, you cannot be my disciple. That doesn't seem very nice. We have the fundamental injustice and immorality of the Christian moral system itself. We have supposedly the story of Adam and Eve, who before they knew the difference between good and evil, were told, don't eat from this tree. Now, what a silly thing. But anyway, don't eat from this tree. And so they went ahead and did this. And then they were condemned. Because only until they ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil did they know the meaning of disobedience. They didn't know they were being disobedient until they ate the apple. And so that's bad enough that God would punish them for an act which was morally meaningless to them until it was committed. But then he supposedly punished all humankind from then on. How unjust. How horrible. And then it demanded human sacrifice. Human sacrifice. The book of Leviticus tells you the circumstances under which you should sacrifice human beings. And we have the case of the sacrifice of Jephthah's daughter, in which this allegedly was carried out. But then we have to sacrifice a human being who also at the same time was supposedly a god. Now, how a god can die, I'd like to know. If it dies, it's not a god. It's as simple as that. But supposedly this Jesus was a god, and he did die. And because he was totally innocent, this somehow wipes out this inherited sin, which wasn't a just thing in the first place. Now, that system of ethics, I submit, is monstrous. It is colossally unjust. And any person in the audience here, if he or she thought just a little while, could come up with an ethical system far better than that. We have a problem from ethics then to God himself. And this goes back to the philosopher Epicurus. He says, either God wants to abolish evil and cannot, or he can but does not want to, or he cannot and does not want to. If he wants to but cannot, he is impotent. If he can but does not want to, then he is wicked. If he neither can nor wants to, he is both powerless and wicked. But if, as they say, God can abolish evil, and God really wants to do it, then why is there evil in the world? This points out the idea that the concept of an infinite God who is perfectly good, all-powerful, omniscient, and so on, is incoherent. It is a contradiction in terms. The pieces do not fit together. If there is a God and he is all-powerful and all-good, there should be no evil in the world. There should be neither natural evil, the suffering that has taken place in these billions of years of evolution should not have occurred. God could have had a much better way to create the universe than evolution. And the moral evils that we see around us also would not exist. And so I think that this whole thing about ethics can be laid to rest. And I think with this, the concept of an all-powerful God who is omniscient and perfectly good also can be laid to rest. Thank you.
In my final speech, I'd like to look at those two contentions that I began this evening with and see how they fared in the course of the debate. First, I allege that there's no good evidence that atheism is true. I think that has certainly been abundantly evidenced in tonight's debate. We've not heard a single argument to show that God does not exist. Now, Mr. Zindler says, but you don't need to do this because the proposition that God exists or does not exist is meaningless. Atheism is just as meaningless as theism on this view. And I said, but that's self-refuting. He says, no, this is just how we use language. That's not the case. Remember I said that if you use this verification principle of meaning, you cut out ethics, you cut out aesthetics, you cut out metaphysics, you cut out many realms of theoretical science. The verification principle of meaning is simply false, and that's why it's universally rejected today. He says, but what if I say, I am God and created you? The problem with that assertion is not that it's meaningless. The problem is that it's false. It is meaningful, and it's false. That's the point. But the question is, what evidence do we have to show that there is no God at all? He hasn't given us any. Well, now he has. He says, we've got the problem of evil. This shows that God doesn't exist. Let me make two comments here. Number one, there is no logical inconsistency ever been demonstrated between the two statements, God exists and evil exists. If you are to show a contradiction, there must be some hidden premises that would bring this out. But no atheist has ever been able to find those hidden premises. Peter Van Inwagen, philosopher at University of Syracuse, says, it used to be widely held that evil was incompatible with the existence of God, that no possible world contained both God and evil. So far as I am able to tell, this is no longer defended. The logical problem of evil has been solved. Secondly, I would argue that evil is actually indirect proof that God exists. Here's the proof. Number one, if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Atheists and theists concur on this. Two, evil exists. Three, therefore, objective values do exist. Some things are really evil. Four, therefore, God exists. So that paradoxically, even though evil in one sense calls into question God's existence, in a deeper sense it actually demonstrates God's existence because without God, there wouldn't be any foundation for calling anything evil. So in addition to the five arguments I've given, we've now got the argument from evolution and the argument from evil for the existence of God. Thank you, Mr. Zindler. Now, in review of the other points that I made, we've yet to see any answer to the argument for creator of the universe based on the Big Bang or the scientific evidence. He's yet to explain where the universe came from on the atheistic view. Secondly, he's yet to explain the incredible complexity of the universe. Remember that figure from Donald Page I gave. Thirdly, what about objective moral values? He said, but look, we can have enlightened self-interest, we can cooperate with each other. My point is that the decision to cooperate on this view is arbitrary. There is no objective reason to cooperate except for pure self-interest. And what that means is that there literally are no objective moral values. And I think this is one of the most drastic shortcomings of atheism. He says, but look at all the unethical things commanded in Scripture. That actually supports my point. You see, you couldn't judge those things to be unethical or wrong without an absolute standard of right and wrong by which to say those things are unworthy of God or whatever. On the atheistic view, whatever is right, because there is no source of objective moral value. They're just the biological, sociological product of evolution. It's complete relativism and nihilism, just as Nietzsche saw. Finally, what about the evidence pointing to God's revealing himself in Jesus? All we had here was the question, well, how can God die? Well, very simply, Christ died in his human nature, not in his divine nature. Finally, God can be immediately known and experienced. You know, Mr. Zindler has never denied this. And I want to close by mentioning that point. There are probably a lot of people here tonight who are seeking for the meaning to their life and existence. I want to encourage you to go home tonight, to think about what we've had to say and ask yourself, could it really be true? Could there really exist a God who loves me and cares enough about me that he would take on human form in Christ to die for me and to bring me into fellowship with him? I wasn't raised in a church-going family, but as a teenager, I heard this message for the first time, and it revolutionized my life. I would just encourage you, if you feel that this could be something that might be true, that you would also make this exploration yourself. Begin to read the New Testament and ask yourself, could this message be true? I think you'll find it could change your life just as it changed mine.
I would say, listening to Dr. Craig repeat my evolution article argument and my evil argument, and try to convert those to a proof of God, that what he has unwittingly done is proven the existence of a devil. Because those things I'm talking about are describing an evil being, not a perfectly good being. A being that creates us over all these billions of years with all the living and dying and bloodshed of nature, red and tooth and claw, that is the description of a devil, if this is indeed the result of a conscious agent. In fact, of course, we know that evolution proceeds unconsciously. There is no motivator of it. It is completely without intelligence. But if it were the result of intelligence, how would we have to indict that deity? What wickedness would we have to ascribe to it for the evils that we see in nature, to say nothing of the evils that we see within our own kind? He asks for a cause of the universe and thinks that he has given one. He thinks that by saying in the beginning God, we have answered something. Actually, we've only created another question. We have asked, how did God get there? And if God can exist for eternity, then why not the universe? At least we can detect the universe. We cannot detect God. Although he does say we can detect God, that we can feel God internally. Now I have to resist mightily the temptation to go to the ad hominem abusive species here, but I have to tell you quite candidly that the mental hospitals of the world are filled with people to whom God speaks daily, and sometimes all night long. We have to question the sanity of a person who quite sincerely, not speaking metaphorically, says that God has spoken to him or her. This is not usually considered a sign of mental health. And so this internal speaking from God is something that we must be very suspicious about. We cannot a priori rule it out that in some case that might be so. But certainly the general effect of our observations, and those of us who have worked in mental hospitals at one time or another have seen this, we must be very careful about that argument. With regard to God causing the universe, we have a problem. The universe is everything that exists. And if God is the cause of it, God is outside the universe. And that is a contradiction. There cannot be anything outside the universe. God, the universe is all there is. Now, where did it all come from? Well, the evidence is not all in. The physicists had a very serious blow struck to them last week with the demise of the supercollider, which might have been able to answer some very fundamental questions in cosmology. On the other hand, there was some interesting information from the astronomers, the discovery that our galaxy is much heavier than it was thought to be, that there seems to be at least 10 times as much mass in our galaxy and is swallowing up the Large Magellanic Cloud, and that this has some very important implications in cosmology, namely it might mean that the universe is closed. The idea is that since the Big Bang, the universe has been expanding, and we've generally thought that it was just going to go on expanding forever until we die in the heat death. On the other hand, some people have thought that it might collapse back on itself and disappear, and some thought that it might collapse on itself and bounce back. Now, we don't have enough information to really know one way or the other. But an interesting thing is that in quantum physics, there is a principle where things can come out of nothing. So-called virtual particle pairs do continuously come into existence only to annihilate each other. And the idea is being seriously developed by astronomers and cosmologists that the universe itself originated as a quantum fluctuation out of literally nothing and will exist for a while and go back into nothingness at some time, just like the virtual particles. I'd like to end with a quotation from the Gospel of John, the appended last chapter 21, verse 25. And there are also many other errors which Christians have believed, the which, if they should be written, every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Amen.
Why don't we offer a round of applause to both gentlemen. Okay, before you have an opportunity to cast your ballot on who you believe presented the most compelling evidence this evening, now that you've heard the main body of the debate, as we were discussing how it is that we wanted to proceed tonight, we asked Rob how he felt the evening should go, and he said he would like to have 5 minutes in order to talk about his response and his perspective on this issue. And so we said we'd be glad to do that as long as we can then have our representative offer his response and his perspective on what he's heard, and Rob said that's only fair. And so that's what we're going to do before we get around to the voting. Going to give Rob an opportunity to take 5 minutes and to discuss whatever he would like to discuss in relation to this issue and the evidence that he's heard on both sides tonight. He will be then followed by Mark Middleburg, our evangelism director, who will also speak for 5 minutes, at which time we'll begin the voting.
Thank you, Lee. Atheism versus Christianity. Where does the evidence point? Well, I sure am glad that we have this issue resolved. Atheists and Christians have a difference of opinion on whether or not there is a God. We have a difference of opinion on whether or not Jesus was who your Bible claims that he was. Both sides feel that their evidence is compelling. Our differences of opinion regarding the evidence for God or Jesus does not, however, make one side any more or less moral than the other side. Our differences do not mean that one side has better values than the other side. We merely disagree on whether or not the evidence is sufficient to compel someone to believe in God or Jesus. Unfortunately, many people don't understand that our differences are limited to whether the theological evidence points to atheism or Christianity. Because of this misunderstanding, discrimination against atheists is pervasive in our nation. Many people think that if you are an atheist, then you are immoral. In fact, atheists are the leaders in our country when it comes to morality. Atheists do things right not because some make-believe deity parent will punish us if we are bad, but rather because doing things right is the good and decent way to live. Many people think that if you are an atheist, then you are evil. Atheists are good people. We just happen to think that God is make-believe. Many civic organizations have a policy of no felons or atheists allowed. Whenever the government editorializes about religion by putting religious symbols or phrases on government property, it justifies in people's minds this climate of bigotry, hostility, intimidation, intolerance, and discrimination against non-Christians in general and against atheists in particular. That's why I campaign for government neutrality about matters of faith. In state after state in this country, atheists are specifically prohibited by law from holding any government job, testifying in court, serving as a juror, or even serving as a notary public. When we've gone to federal court to challenge these unconstitutional practices, the courts have repeatedly ruled against us, saying that these government policies constitute government neutrality towards atheists. I've gone from town meetings in Illinois to legislative offices in Washington, pleading with our congressmen and senators to sponsor legislation that would provide atheists with the equal protections of the law. The response from the legislators have been that they don't feel the public supports legislation that would protect atheists' constitutionally guaranteed civil rights, and that to sponsor such legislation would be political suicide. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. Since this is on radio, I ask that you respond by saying yes or no. The first question is whether you support Congress adopting civil rights legislation that would guarantee that atheists are treated the same as any other citizen. If you favor such legislation, please say yes. Opposed? Okay, thank you. The other question is whether you would vote to reelect a legislator who supported civil rights legislation for atheists. If you would reelect a legislator, even though he supported civil rights for atheists, please say yes. If you would not reelect a legislator because he supported civil rights legislation for atheists, please say no. Okay. I hope tonight's debate has demonstrated that atheists are just like you, except for our opinion about whether the evidence compels a belief in God or Jesus. I also hope that our elected officials will support civil rights legislation that would provide the equal protections of the law for atheists.
I'd like to start by responding to Rob Sherman a little bit and saying that if we're talking about fair treatment of atheists, that I think we as a church would agree with some of the points that he's making. In fact, this church has as part of its credo that all people matter, regardless of gender, race, or belief system. I could even show you a few Bible verses along those lines, Rob, if you'd like to see some. However, I think you missed, Rob, the point of the debate, because this was not supposed to be a political discussion. The point of this debate is, where does the evidence point, toward Christianity or atheism? And before we go on to the next subject, I'd just like to put it on the record that the group that you're a part of, Rob, the American Atheists, likes to portray itself as a benign organization that is trying to defend atheists who get all beat up for the infringement of civil rights and so forth. But I'd just like to point out that the American atheists are known for verbally mocking and ridiculing the Church of Jesus Christ. The American Atheist magazine is known for promoting products like this one out of their magazine, where you can buy bumper stickers that say things like "Jesus Christ, super fraud," "Save you, God can't even cure acne," and it displays a bumper sticker that says "Jesus is lard." You know, playing on "Jesus is Lord," it says "Jesus is lard." They even promote a Christmas card with a picture of Santa Claus being crucified on a cross, and the inscription says that Santa died for your presence. In fact, the founder, Madeline Marie O'Hare, was quoted in the Saturday Evening Post saying, "I want to walk down any street in America and not see a cross or any other sign of religion." And just tonight, Frank Zindler said, "Let all these groups, religious groups, get up and obliterate each other. It'll make my job a lot easier." This does not sound to me so much like a goal of separation of church and state, as much as the elimination of the church altogether. Now, a few specific comments on the debate. Largely what I heard was a positive case for Christianity. I heard Dr. Craig present evidence that was philosophical, first of all. Under the philosophical heading, he presented evidence that the origin of the universe and the evidence there points toward Christianity, that the design in the universe points toward the intelligent designer that is discussed in the Bible, and that moral values have their foundation in the God of the Bible. Secondly, he gave historical evidence to show the reliability of the basic historical narrative in the Bible, as well as the evidence for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And finally, he gave some experiential evidence pointing to the fact that God changes lives. And I just want to add to that that he's changed mine, and you're in a church where thousands of lives have been changed. And in fact, just a few hours ago, we saw the miracle of 500 changed lives of people who were baptized right on this very stage. What I heard from Mr. Zindler was largely a denial of the positive case that Dr. Craig presented. And that is in spite of the fact that he signed up for a debate titled, and he knew the title, "Atheism versus Christianity, Which Way Does the Evidence Point? Where Does the Evidence Point?" He signed up for a debate that said, "I will give positive evidence for my case." Largely, I did not hear that. And so instead of building his own positive case, I felt that mostly what we heard was rock throwing at the case that Dr. Craig presented. So, for me at least, and this is personal opinion, it seemed easy to determine which way tonight the evidence pointed. I'd like to now end with a brief challenge to three groups of people. And it's based on a verse that I think we can all agree on, 1 Thessalonians 5:21, that says, "Test all things, hold fast to that which is good." If you are a skeptic, I hope tonight you've realized that there's solid philosophical, historical, and evidential evidence for the truthfulness of Christianity, and that it's a critical question worth looking into, and we as a church are here to help you do that. If you're a Christian, I hope you saw that though there are challenges to our faith, if you study, it stands. And if you are a seeker, I challenge you to get off the fence and to start taking steps towards seeking the truth of Christianity. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have an opportunity in a few minutes for you to ask questions. You can have a certain number of people have an opportunity to ask questions of Dr. Zindler or Mr. Zindler or Dr. Craig. And before we do that, though, we want to take a vote on which way the evidence did point. Now, if you didn't get a program that has a ballot in it, if you want to raise your hand, an usher will give you one. Don't take a second. Just because this is Cook County, keep it on the up and up. Now, it's very important. Okay, it's okay to hiss me, right? Fine. Okay. It's very, very important. Please listen carefully to this. We are not asking you what you believe in this vote. What is the question? You see it on your ballot on the third panel of the inside of your program. This is the question. Based on the evidence you heard during tonight's debate, which side do you believe presented the most compelling case? That's the question. Now, if you are a Christian and you believe that Mr. Zindler presented the most compelling case tonight, put down Frank Zindler, atheism, presented the most compelling case. If you are an atheist and you believe that Dr. Craig presented the most compelling evidence tonight, vote for Dr. Craig. This is on who presented the most compelling case tonight. And we'll be, during the question and answer session, we'll be downstairs trying to count these very quickly, and we should be able to do that. We think we've got it set up pretty slickly. We'll see. Now, a couple of other key things before you vote. Has a couple other questions on the bottom of that ballot. If you would mind, I hope you wouldn't mind filling those out. It's an effort to try to get at the issue of what your spiritual situation was as you came in tonight and whether or not this debate had any impact in terms of moving you one way or the other in your spiritual journey. So I hope you'll fill that out as well. It's important to note, too, one last thing. On the reverse side of that ballot, if you would like more information about Willow Creek Church, a church for the unchurched, a church where people can come and investigate the evidence, then you can fill that out to get more information. Or there's a little box there you can check if you're interested in being part of a small group of people who have questions, who are skeptics, and say, I want to ask some questions and work this out. If you'd like to be part of a small group that over time would like to do that, on the reverse side you can mark that box and we'll give you information on how you might be able to do that if you would like to. So let me just give you a few moments to vote. After you voted, what we're going to ask you to do is turn the ballot over, pass it to either aisle, and then in a couple of minutes we're going to have ushers come up the aisles, and whoever is in that aisle seat, you have a grave responsibility to hang on to those ballots and not pocket any and put them in the box as it comes by. So I'll give you a moment, and then we'll begin the question and answer time. It's been an education for me. I think I'm getting the knack of it, so 30 seconds at the most on the questions. The way it's going to work is this line of people will be able to ask questions of Dr. Craig. Sorry, you want to run over here quick? this microphone will be those who have questions for Mr. Zindler. Now, the person who asks the question is asked the question. So in other words, if you ask a question of Mr. Zindler, he will have 2 minutes to respond. And Frankie, your time is up there. You get the 2 minutes, and your clock is over here. You get 1 minute as a rebuttal to the response. Then if the question for Dr. Craig is 2 minutes, and Mr. Zindler gets 1 minute. You see how we're working it? Good. Okay, so let's start over here. You look disappointed.
I'm very disappointed.
I'm sorry.
Can I run over there?
I don't know. If they'll let you in line, you can do it.
Would you let me
in line? Yeah, let her in line. Come on. Run. You got to run, though. But sorry, we're still starting over here, so. You have 30 seconds, sir. Would you like to say your question to Dr. Craig?
Thank you. I think this whole line would like to move over there, so I'll put the question to Dr. Craig. Dr. Craig, if you were Mr. Zindler, how would you reply to the following? Would you agree with a statement such as child pornography is immoral, even though morality cannot be proven scientifically in a laboratory experiment? And if so, what is the genetic source of morality if we humans have descended from apes?
Okay.
One of the things that has disturbed me most about this debate this evening is the allegation that what I'm arguing here in this third argument is some sort of ad hominem fallacy. On the contrary, I think that this is one of the most fundamentally important ethical questions that we can ask. Namely, what is the basis for the common values that we both believe in? The problem isn't that the atheist has the wrong values. The problem is that his worldview provides no foundation for those values. On the atheist view, moral values are simply the byproduct of socio-biological evolution, and there is no objective basis for affirming them. So I think the gentleman is absolutely correct. There isn't any grounds for saying that child pornography is wrong or that it's good. These are morally neutral questions. And the horror of this view, I think, was brought out in a recent book by Peter Haas called Morality After Auschwitz. He asked the question, how could an entire society have willingly participated in a state-sponsored program of mass torture and extermination of Jews? Listen to his answer. He says, far from being contemptuous of ethics, the perpetrators acted in strict conformity with an ethic that held that mass extermination of the Jews and Gypsies was justified. The Holocaust was possible only because a new ethic was in place that did not define the arrest and deportation of Jews as wrong, and in fact defined it as ethically tolerable and good. The thing that Haas points out is that because of its coherence and internal consistency, the Nazi ethic could not be discredited from within. It was internally consistent. The only way you could criticize the Nazi ethic is by having a transcendent vantage point that transcends cultural relative values and gives you an absolute standard of right and wrong. On the atheist view, you are simply lost in socio-cultural relativism, and there is no basis for affirming these common values that we all want to hold dear.
Okay. 1 minute response.
I would say, of course, there are no ethical values written in the stars. In that sense, they are not absolute. Without human beings, there is no good or bad. These are human constructions. Now, we did evolve as social species, not as solitary animals. And because we evolved as social species, our nervous systems are wired up in certain ways. And this means that we are pre-wired to have a sympathy with our fellow humans. It doesn't always work, but statistically it does, and we stay as social species. The person who is looking for ethics in nature must not make the error, however, of thinking that what is true in evolutionary history is necessarily desirable or is necessarily true. Because genocide seems to have evolved with us, that does not mean that it is true. My system of enlightened self-interest, I think, gets us beyond that.
Okay. You've waited so long.
Thank you.
And worked so hard to be able to ask this question. So
okay.
This is to Mr. Rosenberg.
Right. I had a question. When you were talking about your friend that was hypnotized with you, you concluded that because you weren't able to take a picture of what he saw, that it was not, in fact, real. And it seems to me that a lot of what you conclude to be fact or our imaginations is by something you can touch and see or take a photograph of. That's what the words you used. You took a photograph. You couldn't take a photograph of it, so therefore it wasn't real. That was your conclusion. And I'd like to know, is that in fact what you're saying, if you cannot take a photograph of something, that it is not real?
Well, certainly not in general terms. I would not assert that, because you cannot take a picture certainly without magnification of an atom and so on, and certainly we accept that atoms and even subatomic particles exist in some sense. I brought that example up simply to show that people can have these very vivid psychological experiences without anyone supposing that there need be something external which is actually impinging upon the eyes and so on. That is to say, visual experience, just like auditory experience, is capable of being generated internally in the brain. And as a neurophysiologist, I've been very interested in that. And of course, one of the things we think about is the description of St. Paul's visions. He doesn't record them himself. We have this in the book of Acts, however. But this is a pretty good description of temporal lobe epilepsy, as far as I can see, where because of abnormal firing in the temporal lobe, the person sees an aura of light, hears voices, sometimes coherent, sometimes not coherent. But we do not have to suppose that there really was something out there, in the sense that I'm looking at you right now. We can have visions. We can have very, very lucid and vivid visions and auditory things also, without there being anything there. And I should confess that I once myself had an auditory hallucination. It lasted half an hour. I had been working as a dishwasher with loud rock music piped in for hours. And the moment I got out and went into the parking lot to go to my car, a full symphony orchestra struck up playing Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto. Now, I understood why I was having that experience, fortunately, but it lasted almost half an hour It was extremely vivid, and it wasn't a revelation.
Okay. Response?
Let me give four reasons why I think you can't dismiss the resurrection appearances as mere hallucinations. Number one, the hallucination hypothesis cannot explain the physical nature of the appearances. Remember, they were extramental in character. They were physically tangible. Secondly, the number and various circumstances of the appearances preclude hallucinations. Christ wasn't seen just once, but on many times, not just by individuals, but by groups, as many as 500 people. He was seen not just by believers, but by doubters, even enemies. Thirdly, hallucinations would not have led to belief in Jesus' resurrection. Given Jewish beliefs in the first century about the separation of the soul and body at death, if the disciples had hallucinated, they would have simply seen visions of Jesus in Abraham's bosom or heaven. That would have led them merely to say Jesus had been translated or assumed into heaven, but not resurrected from the dead. Finally, hallucinations do nothing to explain the empty tomb, and therefore it fails as a full and convincing answer.
Okay. Question for Dr. Craig.
Yes, Dr. Craig. In making reference to Solomon and the Second Commandment, you asserted that God is not material, that his being is immense and universal. How then could such a being be embodied in the person of Jesus Christ?
I think that the answer to the question is essentially the same way in which your immaterial self can be embodied in your physical body. I think of you as a combination of soul and body. I'm not a materialist and a determinist as Mr. Zindler is. I believe that human beings are units that have immaterial and physical portions. And in essence, what the incarnation says is that the mind or the soul of Jesus of Nazareth was the second person of the Trinity. And therefore, I don't see any more difficulty in having an incarnation of a divine mind than I do in seeing an incarnation, in our own case, of a human finite mind. The degree of infinitude of the mind doesn't have anything to do with physical size, like trying to, you know, get a huge physical being into a little shape. But since precisely because God is immaterial, precisely because he's of the order of mind, he can be conjoined to a finite individual. So I don't see that as a difficulty, I guess.
Okay. Presumably?
Well, of course, I would say two things, at least. First of all, a number of other gods came into the bodies of other ancient people. At least we're supposed to believe that if we read our mythology books. And so that was not really all that unusual in Jesus. But the other thing is this idea of a disembodied mind. Now, from what we understand of neurophysiology, the process of mind is exactly that. It is a process. It's not a thing. It is a dynamic relationship which arises as a result of the electrochemical changes within the brain. And as long as the brain is operating in a certain way, within certain limits, we have consciousness, we have mentation, we have sensation. If you change that slightly with LSD molecules or alcohol molecules or low blood sugar and whatnot, you lose the mind. To think that the mind can survive the wreck of the brain and become disembodied is like thinking that 70 miles an hour can survive the wreck of a car.
Okay, question for Mr. Zindler from this side.
It's a two-parter.
Is that okay? Two-parter. We never talked about this. Okay, go ahead.
Make that a double
on
your...
You got 30 seconds, though.
Okay, quick. You stated, and I want to be sure I understand your statement, you do not believe that a Jesus Christ, a man named Jesus Christ, lived on this earth. Is that correct, sir?
Yes.
Okay, now, can you help me understand how if a respected ancient historian named Josephus, whom I'm sure you're well aware of, specifically named a man that lived as Jesus, that was named Jesus Christ, and in several, parts of his chronicles, I would imagine would be the word to use. How would you explain that, sir? And he had no, and
okay,
he did not believe in Christ.
Okay, that's a good question, but we got time. Go ahead.
All right. That's a good question. First of all, keep in mind, Josephus was born after Jesus is supposed to have died. And so he is not writing as an eyewitness. Now, I did not claim that eyewitness accounts are the only way that history can be written, but I want to make it clear that Josephus was not an eyewitness. He wrote late enough. He wrote at a time when the Gospels, as we know them, and a number of other Gospels that perhaps you don't know about, were being written or had already been written. And so if those passages in Josephus were indeed written by Josephus, it would reflect nothing more than the fact that he was familiar with Christian propaganda, which already at that time, by the end of the first century, was quite widespread. And so actually we would not be too surprised that, in fact, we would expect a lot more historians to mention something, at least just by report, from the evangelists that were sent out. As a matter of fact, however, you perhaps are aware that the passages in Josephus have been very strongly disputed as being Christian interpolations. The Christians were looking very hard to try to find other documentation, other proof. It was embarrassing that the only proof we had was in the Christian writings themselves. And so a very large number of ancient writers were altered. Their writings were altered. And a number of things were actually created, too, like the supposed correspondence between Seneca and Paul to give a Stoic philosopher's blessing upon St. Paul. It is quite clear to me that the famous Testimonium Flavianum that we all talk about is indeed a Christian interpolation. It intrudes in the text of Josephus, and the idea that there was actually something written by Josephus about it, which was then made more Christian, won't stand because the whole thing intrudes in the text.
Okay. Dr. Craig?
Jesus is mentioned twice by Josephus. This can't be explained away as a result of Josephus knowing only Christian sources, because in his Antiquity of the Jews, chapter 20, section 200, he gives information about Jesus, about the New Testament church not contained in the New Testament. He tells about the martyrdom of Jesus' brother James. He couldn't have gotten this out of the New Testament because James is still alive in the book of Acts, and therefore he's obviously in contact with authentic historical information. It's not an interpolation either because it doesn't intrude. The other passage is connected with two incidences which are confirmed by Suetonius and Tacitus. Also, Josephus' stylistic traits are present in that passage. There was definitely, I think, a Jesus passage in Josephus, even if maybe it was subsequently dressed up a little bit by Christian copyists. R.T. France says it seems safe to assume Josephus spoke of Jesus' wisdom and teaching. Some people called him Messiah, and this, I think, is a consensus of scholarship.
Okay. Where are we at? Over here? Question for Dr. Craig.
Yes, Dr. Craig. It is interesting that there are a number of religions and each claim to hold the secret of divinity. Why would a benevolent God reveal his glory to only a portion of the population and create other people whose only purpose is basically to burn in hell, because they have very little chance of ever hearing the glories of Jesus Christ, and they really will never have a chance to make it?
I think this is an excellent question, but I disagree with the premise that this represents the Christian view. I don't think the Christian view is that these other people don't have a chance to make it. The book of Romans in the first two chapters says that God will give eternal life to anyone who responds to his general revelation in nature and in conscience, and that all persons are responsible for knowing two facts, that there is a creator God who exists, it's evident in nature, and secondly, that they are morally accountable to this God. And the scripture says that if a person will respond in faith to those two truths, that God will give him eternal life. Now, that doesn't mean a person can be saved apart from Christ. It would be that the blood of Christ or the sacrifice of Christ was applied to that person even though he didn't have any conscious knowledge of Christ. So that the offer of salvation is there in general revelation. Now, unfortunately, the sad testimony of the scripture is also that people do not respond to this, that in their sinful proclivities, they suppress this truth. They turn away from God. They turn to idols, gods of their own making, and so forth. But God doesn't send anybody to hell because of lack of information or because they're born in a geographical or historical time
in which the gospel wasn't available to them. The offer of salvation is universal for all people, but the means of its proclamation may differ from place to place and time to time. And it's up to us whether or not we appropriate God's salvation, however that message comes to us. It's not God who sends us to heaven or hell. It's ourselves. It's our own choice. And so I think this is entirely compatible with a loving and just God who wants you to know him and
That's
wants
time.
You to respond.
Okay. Mr. Zindler?
Okay. Well, I wanted to say that the other passages in Josephus are also interpolations, including the John the Baptist ones. But anyway, why did not God reveal himself to Neanderthal man or Homo erectus? Why this particular point in obscure history? Why that particular point? This seems rather whimsical, if not quixotic. Why was this revelation necessary in the first place? If God exists, how could we be even asking the question about his existence? Why would this not be obvious to everyone? If God did his job correctly, everyone should know that he, she, or it exists. And yet, God seems to be playing hide and seek with the people on this planet. And so people say, well, I think I saw him. It's almost like the Elvis sightings, you know. I think that... this is a tremendous indictment against the Christian system because of this peculiarity of one place in time.
Okay, question for Mr. Zindler.
Mr. Zindler, if reason and logic are convention or custom or arise by evolutionary chance out of the material universe, what is your reason for using reason for testing truth and reality? In other words, do you have a reason for your reason, or is it just your blind faith?
The ability to reason, obviously, was something that conferred selective advantage on various primate species. Indeed, the ability to reason and interpret sense data from the environment accurately has been part of the vertebrate evolutionary scheme itself. We find it perhaps most highly developed in the human species, but it certainly exists in our primate cousins as well. We use it because it works. We survive because this nervous system, which functions according to what we call conventionally now the rules of logic, because it works. It's a very pragmatic sort of thing. A species that evolved a logic or a nervous system that supported a logic that was not valid would not survive. It would be weeded out and replaced by a species that had a logic that worked better. And indeed, one of the famous philosophers of science, Karl Popper, has himself developed a theory of epistemology, a theory of knowledge, in which he accounts for these meta-theories themselves in terms of evolution, that there is sort of a natural selection going on among logical systems, among philosophical systems. But actually, my answer is a very simple, pragmatic one. We use it because it works and allows us to survive.
Okay. Dr. Craig, response?
Okay. I think that the question points to a deep incoherence in the atheist point of view. Namely, if our beliefs are formed simply as a result of the selective advantage, that means that our belief-forming mechanisms don't aim at truth. They aim at survival. So how do we know that everything that we believe is not really true? It's just something that helps you to survive. In other words, there's no reason to think that the evolutionary story itself is true rather than just something that has survival value. Worse than that, Mr. Zindler is a determinist, and therefore everything that he thinks is just like, say, having a toothache or a limb growing a leaf. There is no truth to it, it's just all determined. So how do you know that the views that you hold to aren't simply the result of physical stimuli rather than rationality? I think that atheism is ultimately destructive of rationality itself.
Okay. We're running over time. The vote is in, and so I'm going to curtail the rest of the questions. and ask you if you would please thank our participants this evening for the fine job that they did. You can step down. Forward. Thank you. Okay. Before I announce the results, a couple of quick announcements. Okay. One thing, this evening, is somebody we have to really show our appreciation to. I've been watching over here. We have a person doing sign language for the hearing impaired. Could you imagine doing that? I mean, how do you do cosmological? You know, I mean, her fingers must be aching. She'll be in the atrium afterwards with her fingers in cups of cold water. But I hope that some of you will stay after after I announce the vote and we dismiss in just a few minutes. If you go over to our atrium area, it's a hospitality area there, you can have beverages and desserts and discuss what you heard tonight. Don't just sit out, discuss it. Secondly, if you want to talk to someone about spiritual matters, if you go over to our atrium, there's a hospitality room. Somebody's in there, be glad to talk to you about spiritual matters. If you want to get some resources to go the next step, if something has piqued your interest tonight and you say, you know, I'd like to learn more, we have a book table that's in the atrium, or in the lower level is our bookstore. And incidentally, we offered the atheist organization to provide their materials as well for sale, and they declined to do so. So just we made that offer, and but we have materials by Dr. Craig and others who you might want to use in your own research. Also, if you're interested in a cassette tape of tonight's debate, I know there's some things went by pretty quick, and you say, boy, if I could play that back a few times, I'd get it a little better. You can get a cassette tape by stopping at the tape booth in the main lobby or the book table in the atrium or the bookstore on the lower level. Tapes will not be available tonight, but you can have an order placed for one and you receive it very quickly thereafter. Or anytime after Wednesday here at the church, you can get a tape. For information on a videotape, if you're interested in that, call 1-800-876-SEEK, S-E-E-K. That information is in your program. If you want to investigate spiritual matters further, you have questions that you didn't get a chance to ask, 2 weeks from tonight, July 11th, 7 p.m. here at the church, we have a panel that you can come and you can ask your questions of. A panel of staff members from here at the church, and they'll give you obviously a Christian perspective, but if you'd like to, you know, probe further in this area, you're welcome to do that. The information is in your program. As well as, I need to mention, our weekend services are designed for unchurched people, people who are investigating Christianity. And if you'd like to check it out, I invite you to attend our weekend service. Finally, one newspaper columnist who wrote about the debate a few days ago said the people who are really going to win tonight's debate are those people who really take time to reflect on these issues. And I think that's very true. I hope that this stimulates your own curiosity and will spur you on in your own journey of spiritual discovery. We really did just scratch the surface tonight, and I hope you'll take the time to go and dig deeper. Okay, let me, first of all, you might be curious how many people attended this evening. 7,778 people here at the church, which I believe is a record for any one single indoor event here at the church, which is pretty amazing. So thanks for coming. And then I've always wanted to open an envelope with something like this, you know? Okay. The results. Atheist position received, I'm just trying to read, the handwriting's not too good, but the atheist position received 157 votes for 3% of the total. The Christian position received 6,011 votes for a total of 97% of the vote. Thanks for coming tonight. Drive safely in the parking lot. Don't run over any of our traffic guys, okay? Thanks for coming.